Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf.
It's Tuesday, T-minus one, Neil Coulon.
We're at it again. Another Tuesday in the heart of the busy season, the NFL calendar, but of the sports world itself. It all kind of runs downhill now, unless you're a tennis and golf fan, which I guess some people are.
Well, there's more interest in it now because of the merger in golf.
That's been a fun story to follow, let me tell you. Reasonable on all sides.
Yeah, what's interesting is that we'll see what it does for it. But if we go back to 1966, if I had to pinpoint a spot where the NFL then finally took off, was when they merged with the AFL.
It's interesting you bring that up. I was just having a conversation with a colleague of mine who's a big golf fan. What I said was, on some surface level, one might categorize that the move that the Liv Tor made to be similar to what Donald Trump did back with the USFL. Yeah. And in the end, he wrote about this. In the end, he made it out to be as if it was a business deal the whole time. And the idea was he was going to end up being able to sell to the NFL basically to get out of the way. And he pocketed like $1 million off of that. I think that's what the NFL gave him to go away. And he obviously punched that up as a big success. The reason he started the USFL is because they wouldn't let him in the NFL. So,
right, exactly.
I wonder how parallel that is, if it's a market that the Saudis wanted to get in on and weren't going to be able to any other way. So they wanted to create something so outlandish that it was going to draw a lot of attention, if not a lot of money, but sit and wait and see how long it would take for the PGA to buy it out in some way, essentially by giving them a seat at the table. I don't really see that they're getting a whole lot out of some symbolic stuff. I don't know what they're getting beyond a board seat and some say over business decisions. They're not touching the game at all. They're not in charge of it in any way. I think there's a lot of stuff we could talk about now of what if, what we think. I don't think we're really going to know what this means for a while yet. I don't think they're planning on even having that. I think they want to kind of let this cool down for the rest of the year and then go into 24 with a healthier financial outlook than what the PGA had prior to Liv, and then see what it's going to look like at that point.
We're at a point in the NFL right now where obviously capologists, the ones that are trying to balance money, and this goes back to the Bill Walsh conversation about Randy Cross. Randy Cross has always said that Walsh told him, you have 5 years remaining, but only two really good ones. I want the two really good ones. Is that about what we saw with Dalvin Cook this week? We think you got a couple more really good years left, but not the five you want?
I think five is a huge stretch of time for any NFL contract. And it's very easy to sit here and say the devaluation of the running back position. I think it's more of the fact that there are just too many usable ones that will come up over the length of a five-year contract given to a running back. There are too many of them that they can find for cheap. And nobody knows that better right now than the Minnesota Vikings, because Anthony Madison, in my opinion, is at least as good as Cook today. Mm-hmm. And they're getting him for drastically less. And that's on an extension. They got him for two more years. That's a great value contract in a salary cap league the way that they're in. And there are just, not to suggest that Anthony Madison isn't worth the money or he's really easy to find, it's just that they found him in around much later than where they found Dalvin Cook. Now, at the end of their careers, I'm pretty sure people are going to say Dalvin Cook was the better of the two players. But when you're talking about the difference of $13 million versus $2.5 million, it's pretty obvious what direction you're going to go with that. That said, I think Dalvin Cook still has a good amount of utility in the NFL. And the reason the Vikings held on to him was hoping there would be a situation where somebody would say, we'll pay the premium of his contract because we want to acquire him. We don't want to compete in the market for him. We would get him for 1 year for $13 million, basically. This is a move we want to make right now. We'll pay the difference, even if it is, you know, quite a bit above market for what we could get. If we're looking at this as a one-year transaction, Cook is a nice ad. And we'll see him get, he'll have an incentive-laden deal for $6, $7, $8 million, you know, some of which is there to not embarrass the player, make it look like he's going to get a lot more than he will. And I think he'll be an effective player in the NFL. But I'm a big fan of Anthony Madison. I think he's a very underrated player. He's done very well there. And they got him again on an extension that, you know, he was able to negotiate against the market and say, this is what your highest and best value is. This is what your role is going to be. There's just, you know, I think the presence of the idea that the position is devalued hurts the market value because they can just say, well, the position isn't all that valuable. And I think there's a lot to be said about the value of a true three-down running back in the NFL. Not every player is necessarily that, and they're not given time to really kind of grow into that. But when you get a good one, that money is worth it. And I think that the contract that Dalvin Cook signed at the time really was more of a three-year deal, like most of them are, and they got a good amount of value, even if they're paying quite a bit more than even a top five, drafted running back would have been. He's worth, for his skill within the offense of what it used to be, he was worth that. I think he earned what he had. It's just, at the end of the day, that's usually how NFL contracts go. They're three-year deals. They're not true five-year deals. And Vikings got a good amount of value out of him.
How do you view the Saquon Barkley situation? Because he is a three-down back.
You look at Barkley in basically the same way. You're going to get a lot of run out of him for 3 years. He's going to leverage you for five because he's costing a boatload of money without any future connection right now being on the tag. Both sides are leveraged to some degree. That's really what the tag is designed in a pure sense. That's what it's designed to do. They should continue negotiating. If it were me, I would say, you know what, he has not signed the tag yet, so he's not obligated to go to minicamp. Don't go to minicamp. Figure this out over the summer, though. You want a long-term deal. If it has to be a three-year contract, maximize the amount of money that you're going to get in that time. I think that's the direction they need to go. I don't think the players should, running back should look solely for multi-year contracts anymore. And I understand, the more you're getting the ball, the less effective you're going to be later on. Ezekiel Elliott is a great example of that. That's another running back who was able to get a team with the leverage of the tag to give him a five-year deal and was replaced essentially before even the end of year three. Barkley is very likely aware of that. I think Barkley is a higher-end player than Elliott was in his prime. That said, a three-year deal, something around $13, $14 million a season, and make it as much guaranteed as you can get, I think that's a reasonable market interpretation for a running back right now. He doesn't want to have to hit free agency again. If you want to tack the other 2 years onto the deal, that's fine. But, you know, being able to hit free agency earlier rather than later probably is a better strategy to take just because you can see the type of workload that you're going to have in the time that you're there. That's all very easy for me to say. You know, it's not my head that's out there. A five-year deal, you know, everyone would probably rather have that if players are, you know, devaluing quite a bit over the tenure of that contract. But at the same time, you're not getting guaranteed money into your fourth year. So what's the value of that fourth year at a position with rapid declination like the running back position has right now in the NFL? For me, it's almost like I would almost prefer just to take a 2-year deal, you know, right. Maximize like back-to-back tags, maximize that and go into free agency with a head of steam without as many miles as you would have even after 3 full seasons at this point. But it's all a gamble. It's a tough spot for any running back to be. I don't see, certainly not at this point, any value at all to Barkley acting as if he's not going to play for the Giants this season. That wouldn't benefit anybody. So maybe this drags out over the course of the season. I'm not sure. But I think he's better off signing an extension for big money now than he would be next offseason.
Mike Breen just broadcast his 100th career NBA Finals game, which Denver won last night, 94-89. He made a comment this week about the state of sports journalism in the country. And he says it's just essentially negative. And Evan Roberts of WFAN said this about the Mets. The Mets spend $90 million on 2 mercenary pieces of crap who have done nothing. You've done this. You've been in this business a long time. When you talk to younger reporters, how do you discuss the element of criticism with them when they decide to go down that route?
Criticism's a two-sided coin. You need to have it. You need to make it. There's plenty to criticize the New York Mets about right now, and fairly
yeah,
so.
That's true.
Demonizing them, passing them off as one gigantic joke or whatever you can come up with to dunk on them and embarrass them, that's probably not a real good idea. You can be level-headed about your criticism, and you can be a little bit biting in that criticism. But when you go out of your way to try to make them look worse than what they currently look, I think you're towing a very thin line between rightfully going after the subject and, in my opinion at least, unfairly injecting too much of yourself into it. You know, when you want to be when you want to act like a shareholder of the team, you have to bring a lot more. You know, you don't just get to make the passing comment of you know, trying to pull off one-liners and be clever. You've got to put a lot more into that if that's what you're going to do. It's not easy, and I don't want to let anybody off the hook either. And I'm not a fence sitter. You know, I've always been pretty outspoken about what I feel this should why this should happen or why this didn't work. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, the path of explaining why it isn't working instead of finding creative ways to tell people it isn't working is a better one for the sake of a career, for the sake of credibility. At the end of the day, I mean, I don't like to use this just because I think the old school approach to journalism harped on this a little bit too much. If you're not going to stand accountable for your comments in the locker room, in the press room, that doesn't mean that you aren't entitled to make them, but you always should operate as if you have to. I won't go into details, but I made a mistake on a comment that I made in social media a while ago. It taught me something because the person who ultimately was responsible for what I thought had happened reached out to me out of the blue, and this person is, you know, considerably higher up in the world than me. and he was kind about it, but he was certainly pointed in saying, "You are completely wrong about this, just so you know." And he explained it to me, and I learned something that day, and I apologize again. It's know what you're talking about before you do it, because when you focus on the dunk, when you focus on the kill shot, you're going to lose the context of what's really happening. And if the comments you made about the Mets, I mean, it makes me laugh, but it's extreme. You know, you need to have some bona fides in order to say things like that. And at the end of the day, I think level-headed analysis can provide to you the ammunition you need to make the point that this is a complete train wreck, which it is. It's not the end of the world, and you don't need to write it as if it is. Sports don't matter that much. It's not your money that's being spent that's failing on the field. You're upset about your team not winning. I get it. Go about it in I don't want to say a more professional way, but a more level-headed way. You know, be more sensible in what you're saying and just think that at some point, if you have to be, if you're going to be called out for whatever it is that you're saying, you need to be able to back it up with something other than emotion and one-liners, because that doesn't get you very far.
Jacksonville's going to redo their stadium, so there's going to be a couple of years they'll have to play away from it. They could play in Gainesville at the University of Florida. They could play in Orlando. Or they could play at the Daytona International Speedway. Neil, what did you think when you saw that?
I my first and foremost thought was, more than anything, it's like, this is the opportunity they've been waiting for forever, to put a team in London for multiple games. I don't know why it's not just doing that. Something came up, and that's the question that I would ask. And Jacksonville's been the target of that. Ever since Khan bought him with his connections to London, everybody assumed they were moving to London. It always seemed to me the league was more of what was not in favor of that rather than an owner of a new team. They've, you know, rushed quickly to become London's most well-known NFL team. They're over there all the time. I would have thought that that's what they would have done. You know, without having any insight to the logistics of it all. I think the NFL, we've talked about this a lot, I think the NFL really utilizes crowdsourcing of ideas. I think they push stuff out through leaked reports to gauge the fan reaction to it, which is funny to me because I don't think that you need a survey of 100,000 people to figure out whether playing an NFL game at a racetrack is a good idea. It also, too, I don't know anything about the operations end of it. I've spent some time with that. I used to haul stuff in and out of trailers for the Metrodome leading into Vikings games when I was younger. There's a lot of work that goes into that. And if you have a facility that's not built for it, it's chaos. It's really probably just not a good idea. If you have a facility that it meets most of your needs, and every team has an emergency facility. We've seen them used multiple times due to hurricanes, snowstorms, roofs collapsing like happened in Minneapolis. There's another alternate place they're supposed to try and play. Whether that's Gainesville or whatever, I don't know what their contingency plan is, but to roll out Daytona, I have no idea why that would be considered an option. I couldn't imagine the league would want to go through with that. Certainly not over, you know, a strategic economic location like London. You know, a couple places that they play there now. You'd think something, you know, would be available if they needed to do that.
I mean, they could have Jeff Gordon toss the coin. All right, so there you go.
Perfect. Works out well. It's very Jacksonvillean too. I mean, I've been down there for a couple games, and it's a location built for college football, and
it seems like
whoever survived Saturday shows up to Jaguars games the next day.
Yeah, you know, I did a Gator Bowl there. I did a Gator Bowl there. So
yeah, it's the site of you know, Florida Georgia. You can see why.
Yep.
You know, it's built for that. It's crazy though. You go to it, they cover up half the seats for the Jaguars game, and standing room only for Florida Georgia. Clearly the bigger ticket of the two, but it's a fun atmosphere. You don't beat that. You know, the Southern diehard SEC football type of motif. It's just sort of like, you know, the Sunday hangover for the Jaguars game.
Yeah. My friend, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, guys.